Hi, Todd Feinberg here after 6. A business owner in Maryland has been denied benefits under the big COVID bailout, I think it is, in response to his record as a felon with drug and gun charges. And that having been blocked under the Paycheck Protection Program has led to lawsuits challenging whether this is fair or not. And that challenge is coming from the New Civil Liberties Alliance, I think it's called, NCLA. Joining us from there is Jared McLean to explain this. And Jared, first off, welcome. But first off, explain why we have a New Civil Liberties Alliance when we have an old Civil Liberties Union.
NCLU, I'm sorry, I mixed those two up, blended them together. NCLA was formed to focus primarily on the administrative state, which is executive branch agencies. Think about the SEC, the FCC, the FEC, all those acronyms you hear in D.C. And we're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and we bring cases to fight back against government overreach and exclusively in the administrative space.
Okay, so in this case, your argument would be there's government overreach because in the government program, it's not overreaching enough. It needs to hit everybody. It can't be discerning about who gets the benefits.
So, sort of. Our view of the Constitution and how our republic was set up is that the legislature gets to make the laws, and if Congress had wanted to exclude people like Mr. Wilkes, our client, it was in Congress's power to do so, and we wouldn't be litigating this issue. But Congress made the PPP loans available to all small businesses so long as you were open on February 15th, 2020, and you have employees on your payroll.
So this is interesting. What you're saying is that the Congress made the law broadly, and then in the execution of that law, it's a regulatory, I guess what you'd call the deep state, that's deciding it shouldn't go to violent felons. And
right.
So you guys are
overreach.
Yes. Okay, that's interesting. And so this is me as a somebody who believes in liberty, meaning the least government possible. I'm always looking to figure out how to get rid of government doing things that it has no reason to be doing, i.e., the federal government doesn't have a constitutional role in grabbing money out of thin air that doesn't exist and sending it off to states in order to do these kinds of things. That's my limited government. And your limited government is, and I'm not saying this facetiously, but just so listeners understand, your limited government is have the big government program spending money that doesn't exist that will be paid by future generations. Just make sure the money goes to everybody. Don't exclude somebody who's a violent felon.
I'd push back a little just because we don't actually have a position on what Congress should be doing. I think a lot of the people in my office have different personal views on policy matters, but we are also believers in liberty, and we think that the best way to protect liberty is to maintain the separation of powers as the government was designed to have. And so if Congress decides that we should have a $659 billion handout program, that's on Congress, and if people are unhappy with it, people know how to vote out their congressmen. But when an administrative agency, less than 1% of the people in this country can name the administrator of the SBA, and when the administrator of the SBA creates bad policy or oversteps her authority, there's no real constitutional remedy for the people other than filing a lawsuit to ask the article.
Well, yeah, you make a good point, but that kind of goes across our whole government. I mean, most people don't know the SBA exists or under what auspices it's supervised or the name of the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader. There's this morass going on there. And I don't mean to put you on the spot on the constitutional issues, because this isn't exactly why you're here. But if you're comfortable talking about these, I'm just curious why that sense of the need to scrutinize what the federal government does wouldn't extend to the whole idea of taking trillions of dollars and dumping them into the laps of agencies. Like, why isn't that creating the thing that you're trying to sue about on a smaller basis?
Well, I guess if NCLA in general, like all of our cases come against the administrative agencies, or most of our cases at least, we're also suing some state governors, but it's, we're just trying to keep the structure the way the founders intended, because it's really all we can do. And we don't bring many cases in the benefits context. And the case, the Carmen's Corner Store case that we brought against the Small Business Administration, it is a benefit. The Paycheck Protection Program is a benefit. But most people who are interacting with the federal government are interacting with administrative agencies, and that often happens through enforcement actions. And it's government overreach in that sense, where the SEC or some other government agency is coming after you. And when they bring you to trial, an SEC employee is the judge, an SEC employee is the prosecutor, an SEC employee is the appeals body. They're not affording you due process. And so that's the main focus of our work at NCLA. And this is just sort of within our bailiwick, because it's also the Small Business Administration is also overstepping its authority.
Okay. So that all being said, thank you for explaining. We're talking to Jared McLean, staff attorney at the NCLA. The website is nclalegal.org. Let's get to the case, because it is kind of an interesting challenge. What you're saying here is, if the government is going to be borrowing money so it can spend money that future generations will be paying off in order to prop up the economy in a government-caused collapse of the economy, then that money should be given out fairly. And your client in Maryland, and you're a Maryland attorney suing in Maryland district court, or state court, I guess, and the
your federal district court.
What's that?
Yeah, it's in the federal district court, but yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're making the argument, this guy, yes, he was convicted of a felony. He paid his price. He served his sentence, whatever it was. And now you have no right to go back. By the way, he's a model citizen who's turned his life around after that mistake. What is the comeback to that? That seems like a pretty powerful argument.
Yeah, and I know I saw that you had on, you were talking about the recent DACA decision a couple days ago. And
yes,
our argument is similar to the one in that case, but it's a step further too, because it's not just that the agency here, and to take you back to what happened, when Congress passed the CARES Act, they told SBA to distribute this money to any small business that meets the two criteria, and the two criteria being that you were open as of February 15th and you have employees on your payroll. And and SBA said, these are the eligibility requirements, and they listed that. And then in their rule, they said, but might you be ineligible anyway, ? And then they listed 15 types of businesses that they decided that they're not going to give the loans to, one of which is businesses owned by persons with a criminal record. And it's their initial application said, have you been convicted of a felony within the last 7 years? And then 3 days later, they changed it to 5 years. And then a month later, Secretary Mnuchin testified before Congress and said, okay, maybe we'll change to 3 years. And then 2 days after we filed our lawsuit, they changed it to 1 year. And then this Wednesday, on the day the government's brief was due in court, they changed the rule again to tailor the new rule to allow our client, Mr. Wilkes, to get a PPP loan and essentially try to evade judicial review.
Wait a second. This sounds like they just walked into the police station and confessed to the murder.
Yeah, except the twist is that their argument is, now that Mr. Wilkes can get a loan, he no longer court can't tell us that what we did was wrong in the first place.
I just don't This seems like a bizarre situation. Were you surprised by this kind of manipulation, or is this how the government always responds?
So we have some other cases where the government has manipulated things. We have a lawsuit right now in the Southern District of New York challenging the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and there's also been some hijinks by the government in that case. But I think what's going on with the SBA here is just like a another step beyond, because usually when an agency makes a new rule, it goes through notice and comment rulemaking, and the public gets 30 or 60 days to review the rule, and then the agency gets 30 days to review the public's comments, and then the rule eventually goes into effect. But because the PPP money, Congress wanted it to go to businesses immediately, they waived all those rules, and it backfired in the sense that SBA has just been able to create and change and change and change rules on a whim.
So if we look at what's going, you continue to pursue the same suit, even though they tried to make your suit irrelevant by changing the rules. And your argument then is that, look, this shows how random they are about this, and they shouldn't be allowed to escape after the lawsuit's filed. We want to make them honest in the future. Is that the approach you take?
That's you pretty much nailed it. There's two parts to it. The one is that, just like you said, this shows just how arbitrarily they've been behaving the whole time. And the other part is there's like this nuanced legal doctrine that if the defendant voluntarily stops its illegal behavior, but there's nothing to keep them from restarting the illegal behavior, the court can still step in and rule that its behavior was unlawful. And that's what we're asking the court to do now, because we filed our complaint on June 10th, and in 14 days after we filed our complaint, they changed the rule twice again on us. And what's to stop them from doing it again unless the court intervenes?
All right, doesn't this, you know, every attorney I know almost wants out of the business. And you seem like a young guy. I'm curious if this, seeing how slimy big organizations are, government organizations in general, does this sour you at all to this kind of work?
It's disheartening, but it's also motivating in the same sense, because these big, and I think you're right that in a lot of ways that the government is just acting like a giant corporation, except the courts don't hold it to the same standard, because when the courts see a government attorney on the brief, they think that they have, like, there's just this like air around them, and they get extra deference. The courts are less likely to believe they're acting in bad faith, or that less likely to believe they're lying. And I say it's motivating because knowing that this is happening, we as attorneys have the skill to do something about it. And
yeah, you want to keep people honest, and so, but it just seems a little bit like, pardon the analogy, but it's like your job is to go into the sewer and eliminate the stench, and it just seems like a tall order.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way sometimes.
And it's interesting what you said. I have this political view that the only institutions we can have any respect for in our society are big businesses or small businesses. I don't mean to say big businesses, but business, because business creates jobs. So as vile as they might be at times, at least it's within the context of producing good. And I don't see the good in this chain of events. The government decides to dump trillions of dollars that doesn't exist into the marketplace to cover up the disastrous decisions they've made around the economy without there being any kind of conversation about whether those are good decisions or not. And then disperse it into these government agencies, which will make their own undemocratic decisions about how to use it. And then the only protection we have is government lawyers like you coming in to keep them honest. That seems like a big structural mess to me.
It is, and I think it's only the mess is only made that much worse by what I said about the deference that the government and the government attorneys receive. Because one thing we fight against.
So they're cozy with each other. Is that what you're saying? And that makes you, like, it's even harder for you to pierce the assumption of decency on the part of the government that the court holds?
So I think there's two parts to it. The one is an actual formalistic deference that they receive, and the other is just sort of an intrinsic deference. To start with the second one first, most of these judges used to be government attorneys, and so when they see a government attorney come in, they think, I know where you're coming from, I know the good work you're doing, and they're more likely to give them the benefit of the doubt because they're representing the government. But what NCLA is mainly focused on is fighting against doctrinal deference to government agencies, because there's rules and judge-made rules in place that have decided when a government agency interprets its own rules or interprets the statute that put the agency into effect, the court should just defer to the interpretation that the government gives to it. And so when an organization like NCLA is litigating against the Small Business Administration, and the Small Business Administration says the best interpretation of the CARES Act and the PPP is the one that we put forward, the court is supposed to say, okay, yeah, you're right.
And the court is, because it is part of that same bureaucracy, it's a biased court, is what you're saying. Like we assume they all are. The average person, I think, when you think about courts being biased, it's in the criminal justice system, how the bigger players or the criminals with money are the ones best able to wrangle themselves out of situations. And what you're saying is, in the this kind of supervisory role that the court has to make sure the government isn't being unfair, violating the civil liberties of Americans through the spending of huge amounts of money, all of which I will just throw in here again is unconstitutional in my mind, because it severed the democratic controls over the spending of that money and really usurped the notion of representative government. If the government can use trillions of dollars or billions of dollars of money that doesn't exist in order to tell the states to be doing things that the states didn't ask to be doing, then we've really just spun out of control. And then you're saying that, well, these courts won't even look fairly at these arguments because they're predisposed towards the system. You're basically making the case for Donald Trump and belief in the deep state, which I didn't think we'd get from you today. We're talking to Jared McLean from the New Civil Liberties Alliance. So what's your response to that, Jared?
I say I have two responses. One is, we filed a reply brief this morning in the Carmen's Corner Store case in the District of Maryland, and one of the arguments we made was that it violates due process when the government is a party and asking for deference to its legal interpretations because it biases the judge towards the government's position, and that violates the due process rights of my client.
But what's the alternative? What kind of protection can the court give you against the court being the court?
And well, so that's the thing. This brings us back to the first argument that I was trying to articulate when we spoke, when you were asking, why is it important for us to step in this government benefits case? And we believe that if we can realign the structure of government back to how the founders intended, where the legislature makes the laws, the executive branch enforces the laws, and the courts decide what the law means, then we would all have more liberty. And what the Supreme Court has required these lower court judges to do under things like Chevron deference is abdicate that judicial responsibility. And we're asking the court to keep in mind the oath that judge took under Article 3 of the Constitution. And
oh, wow. That's actually all we have to depend on, huh?
Yeah, and we just want the judges to look at a statute or a rule and decide for themselves what it said and not listen to what the government is telling them it should say.
So is there, you're asking them to find their own humanity, their passion for law, for justice, the things that maybe drove them to go to law school, and to rekindle in their own hearts those things so they can bring a little bit of compassion to the compassionate deep state.
I think that's exactly right. And before I got worked at NCLA, I worked on a court for, I was a clerk for almost 3.5 years, and I understand what it's like to just, every day's a new case, every day's a new case. They start to blend together, and we just want to, like you said, remind the judges of the humanity and that each of these cases are affecting somebody's life. And in this case of Mr. Wilkes, it's not just that he was denied a loan. It's called the Paycheck Protection Program, and all of his employees are out of work, and they're without paychecks, so then they're going on unemployment benefits.
Yeah.
And all of this is for literally no reason.
Jared McLean, you're wonderful. Thank you so much for your patience with me and all my obnoxious questions. I really like being able to pick issues apart like this, and you did a great job explaining them.
Well, thank you for having me on.
All right. Jared McLean from the NCLA, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and that is a fascinating case.
Thank you.
That's it for today's...